Welcome to the Cheltenham School Board Meeting Podcast, online at www.cheltenhamlocal.org or at www.cheltenham.fm.
Cheltenham School Podcast, Finance Committee Meeting, Part 2 of 2 Parts, February 5, 2019.
When you're saying that, are you referring to what I was talking about when I cut spending off? And it's to, I mean, I'm wondering, like, how do unbudgeted initiatives get funded? You know, and who makes those kinds of decisions? And then, so how?
So an example would be, I mean, the most stark one would be if, in the special ed department, I'm not picking on special ed, but this is the one that has the one that's the clearest that you would understand, is if she budgeted a certain amount of money for placement costs or for the students that we have that have special education needs or services. And then say an IEP meeting comes up and the student is not progressing where they need to and need additional services, and she did not account for that. That would be an unbudgeted type of an expense that that's something that we really, really couldn't account for. Normally what you could do is either through the revenues coming in higher, you can account for that. But there should also be some wiggle room in expenditures where you can say, okay, well, we weren't anticipating this, let's take from here. And that just didn't happen in 2017-18.
And when, just tell me a little bit about the budget process. Do you assign departments a particular number, or do they start at like a zero?
So how I started when I first took over as the business manager is I did what was called a zero-based budget. And Matt Malinowski also did that for the board members that were here too. So when he came in after Ms. Gover, he basically said, you guys are starting at zero, build your budget based upon what you need. Which means everybody was dumping stuff in, and then what you're able to do with that is then you can trend over the next couple of years to actually see where spend is. And then from there, he switched and he gave allocations in certain areas. So I followed that model to kind of get things realigned, and we had some new administrators, and so it was their first look at budget. So it's like, build your budget based upon the initiatives that you have going on. We'll take a look at it. We'll see how it all lands. If we have to make some reductions or cut back and those initiatives can't happen, then we'll do that. But over the year of seeing trend and seeing spending, what we've done at the building level is we've provided allocations. So I have enough historical data to say, what are they spending? At my elementary, Cheltenham Elementary is our biggest, it's our biggest elementary building. The elementary principals are responsible to run their day-to-day operations. So that's making sure teachers have the resources that they need. It's not facilities whatsoever. It's supplies. It's making sure they have replacement books. It's their copiers. It's paper. So it's things like that. It's not special ed initiatives. It's basically making sure everybody has what they need to operate. So I used at the K through 4, Cheltenham Elementary is our biggest building. So I looked at his spend. Everybody else should fall in line with that. So if Myers, who's our smallest, is spending more than Cheltenham Elementary, something's a little out of whack there. So based upon the size, they were provided allocations after I baselined and benchmarked historical spend. And so they were given allocations to work with, and that's what they do have to work with. Obviously, as I go up to EP and Cedarbrook and the high school, those allocations are a little bit bigger. At the department level, what we did this year in some departments is some departments had to cut back 10 to 15%. We said, find us 10 to 15%. Obviously, there's a couple areas that can't do that. Transportation couldn't do it last year. We were trying to figure out how the new contract and how Cedarbrook savings were going to impact this year's budget. So, you know, we budgeted based upon Mr. Custer's expectation of the new contract and the rate and the route, but we didn't say cut your budget by 10%. Special ed is another one. It's very hard to go into special education and say cut your budget by 15% because they're right now special education costs in our district are trending upwards. So she can't really pull back 15% because the stuff she's budgeting for, those are services that are needed. We kind of don't have control over those. Some we possibly might with decisions that are being made, but others we don't. Pupil services is the same because that covers your nurses, that's covering guidance, that's covering your general ed out of placement costs. So there's just a couple departments that you can't really give allocations to because based upon last year's spend or things or anomalies that happened, they might have to build cushion into their next year's budget. That is something that's been happening with special education. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One question around the so the $5 million or so from last year. The way I think of that for future years is there's three categories. There's it was unanticipated, but we now recognize it to be necessary to move forward. It was unanticipated, and we can get rid of it. We're going to trim it. And then there's stuff that we did anticipate that we're going to be able to trim.
Right.
And I'm curious, roughly, because that $5 million, some of those three categories are going to have to be baked into the future budget.
Yes.
Do you have a sense of how much of that $5 million, not necessarily what areas, but what percentage of that $5 million is in that we're going to be able to get rid of it?
Okay, so you always do this thing.
I'm sorry.
You jump to my next presentation, so I'll be able to answer that question in the next presentation. You'll see it, and I think the numbers when you see it, you'll understand.
Okay. And ultimately,
if only that worked with the lottery. If you were able to project, I would. Let's go out tonight.
Let's do it.
Not a lottery stuff. It's just to me all the time. But yes.
Vote less support for the idea of having our budget as close, as low variance as possible, just because even if it turns out that is a number we can't afford before we have to use fund balance for, that's anticipated reality and that allows us to make more effective choices. So
I agree
for that.
Special ed revenue.
Say again?
I'm looking at the special ed revenue.
Okay.
And the expenses. And there's probably, I probably can see the monthly bills. Do you see those starting to, I know we spent a lot of money there too. Do you see those starting to kind of catch up at some point?
No. And I'll give you this example and you'll see it later. So Governor Wolf gave his address today. Mm-hmm. And immediately everybody was sending spreadsheets on what the money he is putting into basic ed and special ed. The increases that he's doing, how that impacts us based upon the funding formula. So what I'll tell you is basic ed was a very good number. I was very, very surprised. So we were getting, based upon if this passes at how he projected, we'll get an additional $500,000 in basic ed. Special ed, we will get $130,000+. Yes. So no, it is not. The funding from the federal and state governments are not keeping pace with how much the special ed costs is happening. And it's not just to our district. This is something that I think this is countrywide. I think it's nationwide. I don't think it's just Pennsylvania. I think, we have these discussions all the time, and I actually just had a teacher's going through a principal cert, and he has a finance class, so that was one of his things. Well, special ed, the costs are crazy. What's the government doing to mitigate it? And it's nothing. They're the ones that put the mandates out that we have to provide fair and equitable access in all different ways, but they're not paying for it. And there are some very highly disabled students in our district that cost us a lot of money to transport, and because we just don't have the supports. And I don't think there's some school districts that would have the supports for some of the type of students that we are required to provide education for. So we have a couple students that hit the $200,000 mark between transportation and the services we have to provide. There's some students that they have to have residential placement because that's the only place that they can get the supports to get the education that they need. There are some students that have to have a full-time nurse with them on the bus that we have to pay for because we have to provide education to that student. So it is not an equal or fair allocation, nor are they increasing and funding districts at a pace that is competing with the cost of, and the number of students that are being tagged as special education, I think, nationwide. A big area is autism. That is one that hits our district very, very largely, especially with our MCIU cost plan. Our MCIU cost plan is about $3 million. A third of that is autistic at the elementary level. It's autistic service for our elementary students. So there's a growing number, and I think it just continues to grow as people get tested and they're identified as having special needs or some type of special needs. So the funding absolutely is not fair or equitable, nor is it cover. It's beginning to cover. $131,000 does nothing for us with special ed as an increase.
Now, this may be, I don't know if this is applicable to us or not. I was at the principal's meeting earlier today, and the question came up about how kids were being diagnosed, that maybe all those kids that were being put in special ed should not be being put in special ed. But it was a way to get them out of the mainstream, you know, if they had behavioral problems, whatever, it was a way to get them out of mainstream education. I mean, is that something that we're looking at?
Well, we have two problems, and we share this. We have significantly over-identified students. And it's based on race, no matter who looks at the data. It's just the way it is. And part of that is a lack of an intervention model that provides tier services before they get to that point. The other part is a really calcified mindset that you have to be somebody else's problem. So I can't do it in the classroom, you have to move on. And we've adopted that to the point where we have a significant number, and the data shows that within a short number of years, we almost went up 200 additional special education students from 6-something to 884. So that is a big challenge. But then, let me give you the reverse side of that. The reverse side of that, and just recent conversation today with our solicitors with regards to child fine. Meaning that it is our responsibility to ensure that if students are in need of special education, we should be able to have those identifiable markers before we get to that point. So now we have parents who are arguing when it's time for us to make a decision as a district. Oh, well, you know what? You're saying that my daughter is a junior and she's doing A, B, C, and D. I'm realizing that you should have probably identified her when she was in third grade. And then we go through that particular legal process. And I want to tell you that 9 out of 10 times, we don't fare well in terms of that. And you saw some of the costs with our psychologists in terms of the sheer number of additional individuals that we had in order to provide those particular forms of assessment. So it's really a double-edged sword, and it's also about the, do you go upstream or downstream to fix the issue, and how do you simultaneously do both with respect to that? You want to bring students back, but you don't have the mechanisms inside the building in order to support that. Do you take a gamble and say, well, let's bring them back and we'll develop it? Well, then you get into issues of whether or not you're compliant with the IEP, and that might be a tougher financial burden to cover when you realize that you rushed too quickly to bring them back, and now it's costing you $300,000 as opposed to the $130,000 that you were paying for IEP replacement.
I just have a couple questions. Kara, thank you for, in the presentation, including the areas that are going to be addressed. Because that would have generated about 50 questions? Maybe 10 30. So, thank you for you know, looking looking ahead and giving us that information in this presentation. I just have a couple questions.
Sure.
And one kind of is along with Chris was asking, what kind of psychologist services are we providing on Twister?
Our psychologists mainly provide testing of students who've been identified in needing specialized services. So they don't provide the traditional clinical model that you're thinking about.
I'm not thinking about any model.
Oh, okay. All they do, they're not many. A couple years ago, students were like, well, why can't I have access to a psychologist if I'm having an issue with you to that? But school psychologists are not that type of clinician. They are reserved to when a parent and or a team has made a recommendation that that particular student needs to be tested, they schedule a meeting with a psychologist who takes them through a battery of assessments to determine whether or not they do qualify for special needs.
This is more of a thought for probably another conversation, but what I was thinking about as we continue to have conversations about the rising number of special ed students who have special needs in our district is how do we think about that differently? Because we talk about it as if it's kind of like the analogy that came to my mind was it's like having a baby and being angry that I got to buy diapers and formula for it, right? And so if we know that this is a continuing need, one is, are we being short-sighted not to come up with some type of interventions that put supports in place before kids get to that process? And what is it actually costing us not to do that? The other question or thought I had is around if we already know that the state and the federal government are not going to fund it, what do we do differently? Because those services have to be provided. And so how do we do it so that it does not hit us where our expenditures are higher because we didn't anticipate it, we didn't prepare for it? So those are just two thoughts I had about special education.
Well, if I can address one of them, and if I can channel the number of times that Dr. Smith has reiterated his statement, is that a good special education program is a good gen ed program. 80% of your services should happen in the general ed classroom.
Right, and I remember those.
So it goes back to upstream or downstream. And part of that is the commitment that we needed to significantly address the pedagogical practices in general ed so that we don't feed that particular pipeline. And conversations about shifting practices and providing meaningful research-based interventions, which is why we talked about the multi-tier support system that we wanted to implement, that for some reason there's this gap of communication with respect to what people thought they were doing and what they were actually doing. Oh, we do MTSS. We do provide those interventions, but there was nothing on the ground for that supported the MTSS model, and or it was being facilitated differently. And that is challenging to get people together to look at student, both quantitative and qualitative data, to, heaven forbid, lesson plan, and think about what the next 4 weeks look like for my student, as opposed to, it's Tuesday. What does Wednesday look like? And that's a testimony to excellent planning, just like in facilities, pays off long dividends at the end.
So then my question is, how does the board support that happening? If you know, what is it that we can do, one, and two, as we go into contract negotiations, what role does that play in supporting, for example, MTSS being implemented in the way that it needs to, or does it not?
I'm not sure what the board can do. I'll tell you what the other side will say the board needs to do. We have language from the previous contract that has helped significantly shift that. We'd like to look at other language that allows administration to be able to do what administrators do. Be able to direct teachers when they are not in their lunch or their prep, that those minutes belong to us and we want to develop ways in which to better support support students.
But that's something that has to be negotiated in the contract, or that's already there?
Has to be negotiated in the contract. There's, well, we talked about contract language that prevents certain initiatives to take place. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a conversation. Well, we had a conversation on 31st, and we shared with the board what we thought were some languages that we would like. Mm-hmm. But we can't attack every single language in the contract.
Well, we have to, but that's kind of where we are. Mm-hmm. If it's not there, end up in a battle with everybody around it. Staff.
Yes.
Thank you for the presentation and the information. I have a couple questions. One is, we were talking about under the how did we get here section, we were talking about other benefits, including dental and workers' compensation. Mm-hmm. I have a question about that. During the last BEC negotiation, we put in place, I believe, that the final contract held the short-term disability?
They already had that in place.
They already had that? We were trying to get that with the other group. Okay.
Yes.
Does that touch at all on reducing workers' comp, or totally different?
Totally different.
Because I remember a lot of discussions about trying to get those. So the next question is, under supplies and natural gas specifically, do we purchase our gas through a plan, like we get our gasoline or our transportation fuels purchase?
You buy, there's two different methodologies with natural gas purchasing. One is the transportation. To get from point A to Philadelphia Hub. Years past, people would buy it out of Louisiana and Texas. So you're paying a fee for a number of miles in the pipeline. The pipelines now are coming out of Williamsport, which are closer. So you're now, your index is a lot lower because there's a lot less distance. So that's one aspect of your aggregates. And then you're buying the commodity. Commodity is locked in for a 3-year period because it happened to be very favorable rates. And Marcellus Shale has brought down natural gas dramatically over the past 10 years, or less 10 years ago. So you're currently locked in for 3 years on your transportation and your product coming in. You have to manage here is the usage. And you know, to the point of the previous conversation with that $22,000 worth. Myers, you're using natural gas to heat, but that building automation system not working, you're burning more natural gas than you should.
Yeah.
By putting that building automation system in a fine tune, that will help reduce your cost there. Does that help you with that?
Totally. Thank you. While we're talking about buildings and automation, do the other elementary schools have a functioning automation system that reduces the energy usage? More or less?
So, I think I'll leave it, I can answer that. So yes, you have paid for a building automation system. Is it as user-friendly and functional as it should be? Absolutely not. Let me use this analogy. You buy a house, and you only have $10,000 left after you bought the house. And you have a front yard that looks like, you know, needs some work, and the siding's not so good, and you don't have the Anderson windows. You spend the $10,000 on those things, when you're spending $10,000 because your sewer pipe's backing up, there's no heat in your roof leaks. You guys have been great on making sure your lawn looks good. You're in a build mode, not an operations mode. You need to be in an operations mode, in my opinion, because there's been things that have been left. I'll give you an example, Winco. 4 years ago, you had one unit over top of the office that just last week we tripped over the fact that the thing wasn't running right. The thing was never commissioned. Nothing was ever done. I don't know how many more units are out there like that, to be quite honest with you. Somebody's going to watch the puck if you're in a hockey mode. Nobody watched the puck. You were building buildings.
but nobody made sure they were functioning properly. So there's a lot of room for improvement here. I don't know if it's something you don't want to hear.
Yes. Can't fix it if we don't know about it. So we get our natural gas through a program. Do we get electricity through a program?
Yes.
Something similar, I assume. That's not coming from Louisiana, but...
No.
I'm sorry, I forgot one more. Too many pages. So I have one other question about the transportation and tuition are kind of put together. So you said this, and it went in one of my ears and out my other ear. What's in that again? That's what we're spending to move our kids around, but what tuition is in there? Is that our...
Tuition is the out-of-district tuition.
All the placements.
That didn't spike as much as transportation did last year.
Right.
You have to remember, again, Cedar Brook was kind of the crapshoot in that it was very hard to try to determine, based upon the three sites and things that were happening, to try to control costs with Cedar Brook. There was just no way our hands were tied. So we did spike higher in transportation last year. And that was the bulk of that 1.9 in that 500 object, more so than out of district. We spiked a little bit in out of district, but nothing compared to where transportation was. And that number has come down.
How did all that happen with such a well-planned out move? I don't understand. Thank you.
Hi, Karen. Thank you very much, Disciples, for the presentation. I like the fact that we're looking at projections based on prior year trends to basically figure out if we're on target. And I'm looking at the How Did We Get Here slide as one which we basically, except for PISA, is all within our future. And then mapping that back to the last kind of recommendation follows those kind of pain points to say, this is what we need to focus on going forward.
Right.
Are there any other areas that you're seeing that are not listed that are trending higher so far this year that we're projecting maybe pain points for next year that are not listed yet?
When you see my next slide, we can go through that and you can kind of see that with my projections out. The area is the, right now, the two areas are that 300 and that 500. And part of that back and forth, I can tell you in this budget year, and I'm working with Dr. Gallagher on this for this year and next year, she has different methodologies on how she budgeted moving forward. So starting in 2017-18, she started really, really looking at budget. I think we're still trying to get a handle on the number of special ed students and kind of where the placement was with that big number. In 2018-19, the way that she budgeted based upon, and this is where function comes in, that's that four-digit number to say what area you're spending on. So special ed, which is the 1200 series, has a multitude. It could be emotional support. It could be hearing and deaf impaired. She was budgeting... And kind of mishmashing the 300s and the 500s together, because 300s are also the, and you're going to see this because it's a very, very stark different of a number. You're going to say, we went from 8 million to this number, and how did you budget? When she budgeted, instead of budgeting in the 322s, which is our IU cost plan, that student was categorized as a tuition student. So you're going to see the balance between those two. Those are the two areas right now that I'm really, really targeting, I'm taking a look at, and I'm trying to work with her department and other departments to try to bring those costs out, or at least get an understanding of them. 1920, we have a really, really clear understanding because we have a very beautiful spreadsheet that maps everything out. Prior to that, we did not have that, but I think part of it was she was trying to get a handle on the number. I mean, we identified a lot of special ed students over the last couple of years, so she really didn't, when she got in here, didn't have a handle on who was identified, who wasn't, or who was counted and who wasn't. So we're trying to do a better job of that. It's still a work in progress,
So these are raw numbers, as you'll see my projections. I'm going to dig down deeper. Those projection numbers could change. As we're going through the year, this is my first shot at it. So as now we're getting into the crux of it and spending kind of stops, I'll be able to really, really dig down to say, okay, where are we pinpointing at? For me, the 300s and 500s are my two object areas, and they're two big areas in our budget that we need to really, really take a look at and get that hammered down so that projections and budget to actuals are really right.
Okay, thank you. Just a couple other questions.
Sure.
In terms of the, kind of going back to Dr. McCoy's initial question about the not documenting what's been spent the prior year, and then it gets built into the budget for the following year. And when I look at the $200,000 in unanticipated special ed costs, plus the $890,000 of costs that had to be accrued this year that were incurred the prior year, do we have an existing policy that requires, and a way for you to track, to make sure that you're really, being able to stay on top of the bills and not invoiced appropriately in a timely manner? That's $1 million.
Yes. So here's how this changes. Number one, you have a very efficient accounts payable person that has an understanding that there's, we encumber some things through purchase orders, through blanket purchase orders, and she sees the variance between the two and says, hey, I don't have invoices. That person is really the person that's in the weeds that knows every month we have payments, and if there aren't payments that are being made, that should trigger her. We have a person that's very, very capable and in that position right now. Prior to that, when Ms. Hildebrand, who was here for years, and she was a machine, she knew. There was times where she came to me and she said, we didn't receive an invoice from this, it's sitting on somebody's desk. She was that good with it. The person that replaced her was not. And I'll be very honest with you. In November through about February, I went to Dr. Marseille, and me and Karen Washington, who's the assistant business manager, we were the accounts payable person. It literally was...
In addition to your day job.
It literally was to the point where we would pull invoices, and it would say $1,500, and she would pay $15,000. So we had to really go back, and we got a temp in, we reviewed all the accounts payable. Now, we have checks and balances through the accounting process where she's not the person that signs the checks. So she can print the checks, she can't sign them. So it's not like we were nervous about fraud and she was doing anything wrong. She just was not capable of doing this job. And she didn't really show those signs because she was being trained, and when Karen was sitting next to her training her, she was doing what she needed to do. So we found some discrepancies there. With that happening, that can change your books dramatically, because now, instead of being able to do some comparisons, because invoices weren't being paid on time, they weren't being paid accurately, you don't really have a sense of where you're landing from the prior year to say if you're on track or not, because you're trying to fix everything. So between November and February, we were having those issues and trying to get vendors caught up and paid and getting money back, and all that stuff was happening. So moving forward, that's why you saw a spike in that. Moving forward, I'm tracking that right now. That number is significantly different. It's significantly, which is a tribute to our accounts payable person. The other piece is the analysis that we're doing at both with Dr. Horsey and with Dr. Gallagher on the general ed and special ed out-of-district tuition bills. Now that we have this tracking, I will be able to know by June 30th who we have not received and if we still have an outstanding balance. So based upon the anticipated cost of what we have to pay per student, I will be able to go back and look at the vendors because I know where they're at. And I'll say, listen, this is how much we spent, this is how much is on your spreadsheet. Should we be anticipating, or is this a savings? So we'll be ahead of the game on those costs. What I'll tell you is, at the end of the day, if the tracking happened, that $200,000 wasn't an expected cost. That's one of our students that are placed out of district. Those are two of our students that we know we have to pay those invoices. But when you're in the weeds like that, and I'm not in the weeds with my accounts payable person to that degree, or with the department director, because they're supposed to be analyzing that and understanding that, hey, this is what we have left. That is the differences and the changes that I'm making right now, that people are really, really having that aha moment saying, okay, yeah, we need to be able to tell you if you expect to get hit with a $200,000 charge at the end of the year that you weren't anticipating, because we can't wait until then, we have to tell you now. So also what she's doing is she's tracking, both the Dr. Horsey and Dr. Smith, or Dr. Gallagher, are tracking if students weren't accounted for in the budget, that there was some anomaly that we just didn't anticipate. So then I'll be able to track and know and say, okay, we anticipate that we're not getting savings from anywhere else, that we're going to have to figure this one out. So that'll help us in the projection piece, and it'll help us through the tracking piece. So as we go through March, April, and May, and April will be a good telltale to say where we really are, and have a handle on that. I think salaries and benefits, we have a pretty good handle on that. There might be some savings somewhere if people leave or whatever, but with those two areas, by April into May, we should have a real good understanding of what still is outstanding and what hasn't been paid. I do not expect to be caught off guard or have that happen in the future based upon the measures we put in.
That's great, because I know, you know, we're all humans and we're all fallible, and you might have had somebody in that position that was maybe not the appropriate fit.
Correct.
But is there an automated process that something gets triggered back to you in reporting capacity, in your oversight capacity, so that you kind of know we have 25% of our invoices that have not come in yet? So when you connect with the business manager, along with the folks that report into you, make sure that those get collected.
So I have a standing meeting with my assistant business manager who manages our cash. So Karen Washington is the one that does the cash reports that shows you where our cash is invested and what our bank balances are. So her and I are talking, and she's tracking. And again, it's a little bit difficult because there's some variances because of what happened last year with AP. We're kind of tracking the spikes and the downs with where our cash is, because that's a good indicator too to say, listen, we're ahead of pace of last year, and if we were overspending last year, then blah, 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 or we're under pace, so that's a good thing, too. So I put those controls in, and then on top of that, the feedback and the information that are being provided by the directors are helping. Karen is having monthly meetings with the person that does our bank recs, because that is our double check with our accounts payable person. She's also doing double checks with Deborah to find out where her stacks are to make sure she's not behind. Are you caught up? The board run is happening this week. You guys will get the report of all the payments that happened. That kind of gives us the indication, is she caught up or is she not? If invoices from November are being paid in February, that's a problem. That has not been consistently happening. So that's a kind of a measure and a safe type of measure to say that we're on track and we don't have all these invoices behind. Deborah also is a pit bull with the secretaries to make sure that they're not holding on to stuff.
And she, with me too.
Yes, she is. She really is. She says, listen, this is not, we need to pay this. Our utilities haven't been paid. We need to make sure that they're paid. So she's on top of this way more than it was in the previous. And she almost has that OCD-ness with her that she doesn't like stuff sitting. And there's a due date, and we have to get this paid. So.
And my last more comment, I would just applaud you both for the wonderful presentation to the community yesterday. It was a really comprehensive presentation. And the one thing that I noted was the trending in terms of special ed costs that we talked about earlier. When I, if I recall the data point correctly, 2005, we had like 5% of our students who were identified needing special education services. Now, you know, later, we have 22%. So we're not trending down, we're trending up. The costs are going to continue to increase, and the amount that we're getting from the state's not increasing commensurate with that. So I applaud you for obviously recognizing that that's obviously a key issue, and I think whatever we could do internally to identify, you know, any common ways to address some of the special needs of our students in district, if that's possible, and if not, trying to maximize outside resources if possible. But knowing that that number, at least right now, doesn't seem like it's driving anything up now. And I know we're well aware of that. What's the last question?
I don't have any questions.
Shall we go out to the community on this presentation?
Okay. Myron Goldmill.
Carol, this is one.
From the point of view of transparency, using the actual numbers instead of budget to budget, that's going to save the hours. I don't need the audit reports. If you're doing the auditing, that's tremendous, because comparing budget to budget is worthless. If you have one phony number, you just get another phony number. So what you're doing there is just great. And the projection also, predicting where we're going to be, fabulous. Substitute service is $1 million budgeted. In 17-18, that's in bill was up 1.6, 1.7 million. How much approximately above $1 million do you have any idea?
I think our sub services came in about 1.4.
Okay. Yeah. As a teacher, I'm offended by the money that the district. It's an issue of professionalism. Mm-hmm. I think you partially explained it, but I'm going to ask anyway. In the 300s, we know that the actual went from 6 to 8 million. Mm-hmm. Then in 18-19.
I haven't gotten there yet. Next presentation.
Got it. I'll wait. Then the only other thing I'll ask or comment on. Concerning improving instruction, I know as a teacher, I'll just say as a suggestion, one way to improve what happens in the classroom is to have constant, unannounced principal visits coming in all the time. I'll tell you it doesn't cost any money, but that makes a significant difference. There's a tendency sometimes to wing it. When you don't know if the principal's coming in or not, you're not going to be winging it as often. And I'm not a big planner and saying, you know, plan those week ahead because of what happened in the class, they're not that effective. But going into class knowing what you're going to do and be planned for that day does make a big difference. And if principals are visiting the classrooms, they're going to have a much better idea of what's going on. So one other thing, I don't know if it's an issue or not, it was in the school I taught at. Is copy machine repairs a big issue or not? They don't break down much?
We did, as one of our cost reduction measures, we did a copier and printer audit. So we recently got into, we just renewed our copier grant. I shouldn't say just renewed. It's probably 3 out of the 5 years or 4 out of the 5 years with a new copier vendor. So the copiers are better. They're more high efficiency, and we got a lesser rate. I work with our.
They're not breaking down.
No, they're not.
Oh, okay.
No.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Great job.
Thank you.
John Pierce Shapiro of Milton's Park. Tara, I'm an actuary, so I play with numbers.
Sure.
And I enjoy numbers
awesome.
Probably as much as you do. So, and I often get called upon to opine on an organization's financial reporting strategy. I really like what I saw, so I'm going to echo what I saw here.
Thank you.
I also have asked organizations to do what you're calling a current fiscal year projection. If I understand it, that would be like 3 months of actual and 9 months of what you think is going to happen.
Right.
That has completely transformed organizations in terms of the way they manage their operations, so that's great. One clarification question and one kind of bigger question. How does your variance for expense and revenue equal exactly the variance for your expenditures?
Okay. And I think this is
magic.
Mr. Yes.
Magic.
No, basically, if.
Budget to actual.
The actual to actual. So you're asking how revenue is, we're at a zero. It doesn't show that we're at a deficit. Is that what you're asking?
Well,
I think I have the answer.
I may be misreading your report, but I'm used to thinking of a budget and actual, an audit is a form of actual.
Right.
And then the variance between budget and actual. And I have never seen a variance for revenue
and
equal variance for expenses.
It's because we use fund balance to bridge the difference. So our actual variance, so we put in in the budget, take out the $3,066,000 on the revenue line item where it says fund balance. If you take it back to 963, there's your variance.
Got it.
So we bridge the difference that we had in our deficit with fund balance.
Got it.
It's so like that's retained earnings on the balance sheet.
Yes, that's the link that I just kind of went. Okay.
Mr. Goldman also had to tell
you that. There's going to be some different vocabulary.
Sure.
You know, the question that I have is a little less tactical than that. Is, you know, we have budget, we have actual, and we have audited. And from what I'm hearing, the difference between actual and audited, it was a big surprise. It was the $2 million oops, as we say in the technical term, the $2 million oops. Can you please talk about what came out in the audit that wasn't being reported throughout the year as part of the actual?
So let me not say that the audit found this big deficit. So one of the things that I talked to the board in, I believe it was in December when we first reported this, and the how did we get here type of piece, is even going back into last year's budget, if you look at the variance that happened, there was about a gap, I think, of about $3 million. So that kind of started to trend. So there were assumptions that I made in my budgeting process where I knew that based upon the tax increase and things that we were doing, that our expenses could have come out higher. And I made some assumptions that I thought we would be able to get some savings or reductions in other line items. That assumption did not happen. So in tracking through the year and again finishing up the year, I knew that we were over what we had anticipated using in fund balance. I didn't know how much until the audit was completed, until we kind of got some good numbers, because there were some fund balances and other funds that we used to offset some of the mitigating costs. But it wasn't a surprise. I wasn't caught unaware that we were overspending, because again, my assumptions didn't come into play. So areas where I thought we could save to mitigate some of the costs that were rising, which predominantly were in salaries and benefits, because we've done some hiring. There's been some things that, retirement assumptions that I made that didn't get realized. So things where I thought that we would be able to balance out those increased costs that we had during the budget and that we mitigated with a tax increase, and we filled the one-timers with fund balance and not getting into that cycle where we're using fund balance to gap reoccurring costs. Over the last 2 years, the assumptions didn't come to fruition, which caused us to get into the deficit.
Let me ask a question a little bit differently, if I may, because there's something that maybe it's the late hour, but something that's not clicking here.
I still have two more agenda topics, too, so.
Yeah. I'm not answering, I'm not asking about six of my questions.
Sure.
If we went back in time and looked at the financial statements that were reported, say in July, for the prior school year.
Yes.
Or August, you know, something.
Correct.
But after the year, and we take a look at what the auditor came back.
Yes.
With. What's the difference?
From 16-17 or
17-18? No. 17-18 actual reported as of, let's say, July 1st or August 1st, 17-18.
Okay.
Versus what the auditor is telling us to report for 17-18.
Was there a reconciliation between the two, or did they match?
No, they pretty much matched. They weren't off. So we were at a deficit in August.
Was it the $2 million?
It was slightly higher, yes. We used some fund balance and debt service to offset some of the costs with our debt, yes.
Okay. So when did this $2 million start to hit the... I mean, it was represented to me as a surprise, and maybe that was inaccurate the way it was represented to me.
Okay, so let me interrupt you and tell you this. Again, how did we get here and what we're doing moving forward? The fact that there were no projections out to show where areas that spiked, which was our 300s, which were our 500s, those were not projected out in any type of reporting that I did previously.
But when I, and excuse me for interrupting, I just, I, what I'm having trouble with is there's no projections of June 30th, so or July 1st or August 1st or whatever. You know, actual is actual is actual. And
so I knew in June at the end of the year prior to the audit. Now you have to remember we still have 2 months to close out. So in August, September, which I started this conversation by saying I should have had this conversation in September or November or October, and that didn't happen. We're having it now. So at that point, yes, there was an understanding from my part that we were in this deficit, and the areas I had to do a little digging and looking at what trends caused this and where we were over. But you're asking me to explain why we got here or.
Well, you're clarifying some timing issues. So you have 2 months to pay the run out.
Yes.
So that would be August and September. So October-ish, you were seeing something like a $2 million shortfall.
Correct.
Okay, that's a different. That's fine.
Okay.
That clarifies.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the public? As the chair of this committee, I want to just ask, do we have the stamina to continue? It may be more beneficial to table the last two presentations to next month's presentation, where we'll be fresher and able to evaluate. I mean, it's up to you. Kara.
So let me explain this, because First Look budget is coming out tonight. Everybody has the presentation. I'll give you time to take a look. The plan was to present First Look budget. March was not going to be a regurgitation of this, because we have some work to do. Once you look at First Look budget, it does not include recommendations of how we're going to gap the deficit that we're in right now. Also, we have to go back and I have to do some scrubbing on some key areas that we talked about tonight to see if there's even more savings that we can find to bring the numbers down. So as far as timing is concerned, the next formal board action that I need is in May. You have to approve a final proposed budget. So in light of the lateness of the hour, and I do want to make the comment that this was suggested to happen after the TIF meeting. He just thought that this week couldn't stop, and I'm like, there's no way we can have this conversation. So from my perspective, no, if the board is comfortable with having the information in front of them, it gives them a chance to kind of digest it. Some questions might be generated that I can pre-answer and maybe can be discussed at length. I think it'll be helpful for you guys to see this, but it would not set us back in the timing methodology, because my plan was in April, as we get closer to when retirements come in, because we need to really take a look at that stuff and have a good understanding, April was when you guys were really going to see the budget and how we're balancing budget and what our recommendation is. So if you want to table this until March, I have no problem presenting this in March. Now that you have the information in front of you, it's not going to change. That'll be what I present in March. We might have some additional information as we go back and meet and have some conversations that we can add to this conversation on where we think we're headed as far as finding reductions and recommendations. But the recommendations that we're going to present is really not going to happen until April. May is when I need formal board action. So if the board is comfortable with couching this discussion until next month, I'm fine with that.
I would say that I think a big part of our discussion tonight centered around special ed and its impact on the budget, both in the income that we saw did go up a little bit and clearly the expenditures. If we could get a little bit more of a sense of that, how much of the 300, 500, and 800, because it was an 800 too, how much of that was out of district placement, psychological services, so we have a sense that, that this is our spend on special needs that we don't currently have.
I'm taking it as a hurry paper.
Yeah, it's a motion. It's a motion.
Yeah, but can I ask everyone, though, between now and March, you need to really look at the presentation, and if you have any questions, to pose them to the chairs.
Yes.
They can coordinate posting it this way.
Yep, thank you.
Oh, I thought we were coming back tomorrow night.
We will be here tomorrow night.
Oh, yeah, we will. Grievous.
Thank you.
This concludes this school board recording. This recording is copyright by KD3HW and is released for free distribution under the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivations 3.0 United States license. Podcast sounds courtesy of freesound.org. See the acknowledgement page of the podcast website. Thank you for downloading us, and have a great day.